Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. Well, there are a lot of people these days who argue that biofuels can do a number of things. They can reduce our dependence on imported oil. They can help create green jobs. This morning, we'll be trying to talk, at least in part, a little bit about what government can do, both with regulation and incentives to promote the development and use of biofuels in the United States. We'll also talk a little bit about a conference that is coming up here on the U of I campus, looking at law and regulation when it comes to biofuels. And we have two guests with us in the studio. Both of them here are at the University of Illinois, Jody Enders and Brian Enders. Jody Enders is an attorney by her training. She works in the Energy Biosciences Institute at the U of I, and Brian is Assistant Professor of Agricultural Law in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. I hope that's enough in terms of background. People here at this university like really long titles, so if I've left anything important off, you'll let me know.
I think you've done a great job.
Okay. Yeah. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. Questions from people who are listening. We always invite those. The only thing that we say for people who are calling in is if people can try to keep their questions, comments brief, that'll help us because it'll make it possible for us to get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
We appreciate
it. Maybe here is one way to try and start out. One thing that we know is that now there are a number of countries around the world that are interested in developing biofuels for the reasons that I've cited. They're interested in cutting down their dependence on petroleum. They're interested in the environmental impacts. They may indeed be interested in promoting a domestic industry, you know, for all of those reasons. And they have set targets. They've said, well, what we want to do is have at least a certain percentage of the liquid transportation fuels to be biofuels. And I think generally, I suppose it varies, but generally I think it's about 10%. And then they have set targets for saying, okay, we want this much to be in there and we're going to give it this many years, maybe 10, 20 years. And they have a variety of ways to doing that, to do that. And we could maybe talk a little bit about what we're doing in the United States. Is it possible to say, and I don't know if this is too big a question, but is it possible to say, well, for those countries who have actually set these kind of targets, how well they're doing in getting close to those targets?
Well, I think in the United States, we've certainly set these targets. We'll talk about that, you know, I'm sure in the course of this conversation. And we're quite ahead of the target, actually. There was an initial renewable fuel standard, is what we'll call it, in an energy bill. That set a target for renewable fuels, one of which was corn-based ethanol. And we overshot the target. And the market was producing a lot more corn ethanol than what the government had mandated. And so in the 2007 energy bill, Congress upped the ante, so to say, and put in much higher targets, and I'll even use the word mandates, for the industry to produce renewable fuels. And the first couple of years, we're ahead of target. Now, we'll see what happens in the out years as the targets get a lot more aggressive, and especially as you start mandating items other than corn-based ethanol, mm-hmm. such as advanced biofuels. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're going to need some scientific advancement in order to reach those out year targets where we have some aggressive standards or mandates for biofuels.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, too, what you're going to see now and in the future is the overlay of other sustainability factors other than just pure mandates, you know, that have other agendas like meeting, you know, rural development or providing jobs or a market for our grains. I think now you're going to see the United States, the European Union, the rest of the world thinking about what are the other implications of using biofuels for the environment, for society in developing and underdeveloped countries.
Yeah.
So that may have some effect on whether countries can meet those targets or not.
Yeah. We're as you say, the United States is a big producer of ethanol. And in fact, one of the biggest, I think, in the world, and maybe next to, there's Brazil and there's the United States.
Yeah, Brazil's number one.
Brazil's number one.
The United States is the largest producer. Brazil's the biggest exporter.
That's right.
Okay. Well, we're like one and two, and mostly we're producing ethanol from corn. The Brazilians are producing it from sugar cane. And this gets to what I think is something of a controversy when it comes to biofuels, and that is, well, what's your feedstock going to be? And are there problems associated with using something that is an edible crop? Because you can use stuff that are not. And here, and I know this is something that you're going to be talking about in this conference that's going on, it seems that we're on the brink of maybe a major kind of turning point in how we think about biofuels, and that is shifting away from feedstocks that are edible crops, corn, sugar beets, sugar cane, whatever. You know, there are a lot of different things that you can use. But I think a lot of people are saying we ought to shift away from that to things like either the waste stuff, which you can use, or a purpose-grown crop, switchgrass, miscanthus, stuff like that, that it's a different process. But and it's one that we haven't really developed the technology for yet. But looks like – is that what's happening, that we're moving – a lot of people say, well, we ought to move and we are moving in a different direction?
Yeah, I think, Brian, you can talk more about what's being done in the United States. But in Europe, recently that sort of consideration worked its way into a proposed renewable energy directive and a fuel quality directive where those – that type of crop is emphasized and encouraged so as to avoid that very problem you're talking about, this food versus fuel, the right. displacement of fuel crops. And in the European Union, cellulosic ethanol from things such as waste and residue are actually doubly counted toward the 10% renewable target.
And that's in the United States. That's part of the mandate as far as advanced biofuels in that there's the renewable fuel standard by 2020 is requiring 36 billion gallons a year of renewable fuel, but the amount of corn ethanol is going to be capped at 15 billion gallons a year. So that 21 billion gallons a year is going to have to be non-corn-based renewable fuels. And that's created this incentive to look at crops other than corn. And you know, we produce an awful lot of corn, but we also are a great environment for growing the miscanthus, the switchgrass, industrial hemp, forest residue, even building material waste. Those can all be, theoretically converted into ethanol. Mm-hmm. And pilot projects are going on. The key thing is, how do you commercialize it? How do you do it in an efficient way where you can compete on a cost basis, the conversion on a cost basis with the corn ethanol and, more importantly, on the world market with the sugarcane-based ethanol, yeah. where you're able to convert it at such a lower cost. And that's why Brazil is able to be an exporter of that product. Yeah. And that's really the purpose behind the Energy Biosciences Institute, where we're both a part of, is we – have this mandate. We need to be able to meet it, but we don't have the science yet. And so the EBI, the Energy Biosciences Institute, put together this group of scientists that are looking at what are the scientific or the technical problems from the planting of the particular feedstock to the harvesting to the breakdown of the biomass into the different products that can be converted. And then we're looking at, well, what are all the legal implications or what are the legal barriers to this as well? So you have scientific barriers, you have legal barriers, you have legal incentives, and trying to fit this all together is a massive project. But it's something that as so long as you have this mandate where 21 billion gallons a year are going to have to be these advanced biofuels, yeah. we're going to have to get there.
Well, this it seems to me that this is really an important and difficult point because we've said – we want to have a certain percentage of the liquid transportation fuel to be biofuels. And up until now, the main way that we've been doing that is by ethanol is made from corn. And now we've said, well, we really want to make a major shift here to a different kind of feedstock. And we have set quite ambitious targets. It's a ways out, but set quite ambitious targets for doing that. But at the same time, we actually have to say, we really don't know how to do that. I mean, sort of we do. You know, we have some ideas. That people are working on the technical processes. People here at the University of Illinois are. But in terms of being able to do that on a large scale commercially, we can't. We don't know how to do that yet. We can't do that yet. So what sort of role do you think is there for government in trying to encourage the development of these? Essentially, we're talking about the development of a brand new industry.
Right. And I think there's the government, in my view, has taken two sort of steps. The first step is they've directly invested in some of this scientific research. The Department of Energy has cooperated with other institutions around the country to do something very similar to what the EBI is doing. The EBI is privately funded. Mm-hmm. Through BP, and it's a collaboration with the University of Illinois, Berkeley, and BP. But so the government has directly invested in the scientific discovery, so to say. The second thing they've done is to put in place incentives to encourage this private market investment, the BPs of the world, to say, you know what, this is something that needs to happen. The government's put some incentives in there, whether it's different tax credits on advanced ethanol, different mandates, or even something as simple as accelerated depreciation of a new cellulosic ethanol plant. You can take 50% depreciation in your first year. All of these sort of components go together in this broad overall strategy, realizing that it's not going to be one thing that's going to, you know, sort of turn the key on this. A lot of things need to put together. And we haven't even started talking about the infrastructure, the development that needs to go into place to distribute these large quantities of ethanol and from the refinery all the way to the retail pump.
Yeah.
And I think that's the question that the first day of our conference is really trying to address and answer, is that in the past, government incentives have been very focused on the production side of the actual fuel, without a lot of consideration for infrastructure development, whether it's biomass growing, transporting that biomass to the production plant. There's a lot of infrastructure that's necessary for that. And I think that this conference can play a very large role in ferreting out, you know, ideas and what needs to be done to accomplish that through government policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a caller here who wants to get in on the conversation. Why don't we do that? In Tazewell County on our line number one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I am 100% in favor of renewables, no question. But help me understand how going to something like switchgrass or miscanthus is... Doesn't that take cropland out of food production, just like corn would? Only corn is so obviously a food. And then also, I'm a little worried about miscanthus because it can escape and become a very nasty invasive plant here in Illinois. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, those are they're kind of agronomist questions, but you can if you want to take a shot, go ahead.
Absolutely. I think the caller's exactly correct in that you have a certain amount of cropland that you can devote to agricultural production. And whether you put it in corn or you put it in, we'll just say miscanthus for argument's sake. Mm-hmm. It's not as simple as just how much acreage is in there. It's in your yield per acreage. And if we start measuring yield per acre of ethanol, that's where miscanthus or some of these alternative fuels can win, because they create so much more biomass per acre that then can be converted. That I mean, the exact numbers are in the scientific literature, but mm-hmm. that's pretty much the argument, is you can create more ethanol on a per acre basis from using some of these biomass dedicated crops as opposed to corn, where the only thing you're converting is that tiny corn kernel, as opposed to the whole stalk of a 10-foot tall miscanthus plant.
Well, and I think EBI researchers are also very interested in switchgrass or miscanthus performance on marginal lands, or lands that aren't typically looked at as good food production areas. And I think that those types of crops really have the potential to be grown in those areas that aren't used for food. And I think from an attorney standpoint, policymakers need to recognize that perhaps we need some zoning or emphasis on miscanthus or grass's ability, cellulosic's ability to grow on non-food land.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does that do to, or I mean, right now, in an effort to conserve soil, we all say as farmers, you know, there are certain areas that are really marginal for production that we say, you know, maybe it actually would be better if you don't plant there and that we'll actually pay you not to. What happens to this kind of set aside if we now have an incentive for farmers to plant something, if not corn, well, then okay, we'll plant switchgrass on land that is where there's it's essentially fallow now, where there's nothing growing on it.
Yeah, that's a policy question that, you know, is maybe above my pay grade in that it's a great question, and it has to do with how do you treat conservation reserve program land, or basically the set asides where you're it's highly erodible land, or maybe to improve the soil quality, so you'll plant something like miscanthus, which is a perennial, and it can you know sit there and sort of restore the soil quality. But then once you start, well, you need to harvest this. And that's what we're trying to avoid in some of these CRP lands is the disturbance of the soil via harvesting. And so that's something that's still being sorted out at the federal level, is how should USDA treat these certain set-aside lands? And I think that's a good question. But certainly some of these crops have the potential to be great candidates to restore soil or to protect from soil soil runoff.
I think that a challenge for some of our scientists in EBI is to study the biodiversity benefits of these crops grown in CRP lands, because if you can advocate that, well, you're getting the same sort of benefit even with the harvesting, then growing that type of crop there and receiving an economic benefit from that might be possible. But there needs to be much more research on the benefits on biodiversity of growing crops like miscanthus on CRP lands.
Mm-hmm. Let me just real quickly, and we have some other calls, I'd like to introduce again our guests, Jody and Brian Enders. Jody Enders works in the Energy Biosciences Institute. That's in the Institute for Genomic Biology at the U of I in the Biofuels Law and Regulation Program. I hope I got that all right. Her background is in agricultural food and environmental law. Brian Enders is Assistant Professor of Agricultural Law in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics, ACES, at the U of I. Also has appointments in the Business Economics and Law Program and the Energy Biosciences Institute in the Institute for Genomic Biology. And partly what we're here to do is to talk a little bit about the promotion of biofuels here in the country, and to just mention that here at the university at the end of the week, there's going to be a conference. This is, in fact, the first annual Biofuels Law and Regulation Conference, where they're going to be talking about some of these issues. And I don't know if Jody, you want to talk a little bit more about, just take a minute to talk a little bit more about the conference?
Sure. It would be a great opportunity to put in a plug for our conference. The first day really is focusing on incentivization schemes for second-generation biofuels. And we put together what we think is a fabulous program of speakers who can provide both the basic background to what U.S. and perhaps international incentivization schemes are, but also provide some really good analysis for people out there in the legal community or the scientific community. So we've created a program that can cater to both those sort of audiences. The second day focuses on sustainability standards for biofuels, which is really an emerging topic, like I mentioned before, in the world in terms of these ethanol mandates and how countries are seeking to learn what the other environmental effects of these mandates are. And we think we put together a really great program on Saturday as well. It's Saturday morning, and it closes with a lunch, and it culminates in a talk by actually the CEO of the Renewable Fuels Agency in the United Kingdom about some of the steps that they've taken to both get renewables, increased amounts of renewables into their fuel supply, and their program to integrate other sustainability considerations into that.
So are these, for people who, like the two of you, who work in the area of agricultural law, are there the interest in promoting and developing biofuels, does this raise some legal questions that didn't exist before, or is it that maybe some of the same questions, but you have to look at them in a sort of a different way?
I think that's a great question in that we're still trying to figure it out, in that it certainly does raise some new questions. The previous caller talked about weediness of miscanthus. And sure, that's certainly a concern, and there's statutes in some states that prohibit even the cultivation of some potentially good biomass crops, but they're outlawed because they're weeds in states, whereas in other states they're not. So there's certain legal questions there, legal questions about importation of germplasm that might make a good biostock. And then there are also some real practical concerns for the farmer. It's almost a chicken versus the egg thing. If I'm going to plant a perennial that's going to then feed as a biomass feedstock for an ethanol plant, say miscanthus, but it's going to take a couple of years after I plant it before I can actually start selling it, what am I going to do in that bridge time? And what if that plant's no longer there? Or who's going to pay me in that interim? And those are big questions.
And I think we have someone on our program on Friday, Gavin Maxwell from Ireland, who has worked on that exact question in terms of, in the UK, how a carbon regulatory scheme has actually provided that sort of predictability for farmers to incentivize them to, you know, dive in, plant the cellulosic biomass, and that because they receive that sort of benefit in terms of a carbon credit, they actually are willing to take that risk.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because I think earlier Brian said something about, you know, there might in fact be legal barriers to the development of some of these second generation biofuels. And my thought was, well, gosh, what would we be talking about? And here, just a moment ago, you gave an example. I wouldn't have thought that actually there would be some places where they would say, no, it's illegal for you to plant this. You can't. Even if you wanted to grow it and you thought that you could manage, you can't. You can't put that in the ground.
Right. And that's where part of the difficulty is we're looking at this, you know, you first look at the federal level where, you know, what laws are in place. But then you really have to look at what state laws or even what, you know, county laws might be in place for different things. Other legal barriers might be even transportation aspects. If you think about it, when you're harvesting corn, all of the processing takes place in the field. And what's delivered to the elevator is just the corn kernels. In the biomass context, you want all of it to make it to that plant. So you're going to be transporting a tremendous amount of raw material someplace. And there's going to be impacts on roads. There's going to be impacts on rails. Land use concepts go into place. And so putting – those can all serve as legal barriers as well. There's also legal incentives that are trying to overcome that, is trying to make regional zones or regional areas for biomass production where and there's some federal incentives that were in the latest farm bill that are still – the agency's trying to work its way out and to implement it, but where you would maybe take a cellulosic ethanol plant and put it in a geographic area and then have incentives for a radius surrounding that plant to encourage those farmers to plant the biomass and to bring it in there. So there's a lot of moving parts here, and sometimes there's barriers, sometimes there's incentives, and trying to sort it all out to make it efficient, so once again, it can compete economically with corn-based ethanol in the short run while it's building up the commercial scale, and then also improving the life cycle analysis. In other words, the effect on greenhouse gases and all of this.
Okay. Well, we got some other callers here. Let's talk with them, and we'll take them in order, starting with line one, and that's someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question or two about switchgrass and miscanthus. It seems to me that, contrary to the earlier caller's assertion that it would simply be competing with corn, it would allow you to plant on lands that are not really cropland in the West and even in areas where there are highly erodible lands that are not suitable for row crop. But that probably does introduce another problem in biodiversity, and some of these lands are now producing wildlife. And I'm wondering, would a strategy that might help to overcome this be that it be mandated that, say, 10% of the land has to be planted to native plants, say blue stem and mixtures of prairie grasses on the prairies, and that the farmer be compensated for that land. If it could not be harvested, it would have to remain intact. It would seem to me that switchgrass or miscanthus or any alline crop would help to promote wildlife during the summer, but after the crop is removed, the cover is gone, and that these strips of native wildlife would provide winter cover for these animals and birds.
Well, what do you think?
Well, I think that's where law really can come into play here, and you're not the first person to have thought about how native prairie grasses can really play a part in land use schemes. And I know, for example, in Brazil, they do have laws that require a certain percentage of production dedicated to sugar to be planted in certain native species and restorative species. There's also some discussion going on in certification circles about when you're implementing sustainability standards for biofuel, the non-carbon part of them, certifiers maybe should think about putting a requirement or at least a recommendation in place that biofuels crops be planted in native species so as to encourage biodiversity, because that's one of the facets of a sustainability regulation, is that biofuels preserve or encourage biodiversity. So I think that that is something that regulators all over and certifiers are really considering. And I think scientists are looking at it as well, you know, the viability of native species to whatever area in the world you go.
I'd just like to jump in here with a couple points, is that one of the benefits of a miscanthus is that you don't harvest it in the fall. You actually... It's sturdy enough, and the harvest takes place even on frozen ground or in January and February. There were harvest demonstrations going on or scheduled in February here on the U of I, and then we had a big snowstorm. It sort of – or maybe it was an ice storm. I can't remember.
A blizzard, yeah.
And so they had to delay it. But if it – and so that does provide overwinter habitat, so to say, because the harvest can be offset. It doesn't happen in the fall. Which is also then good for biodiversity and soil conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Another concept that's being talked about is trying to avoid areas of high biological diversity at the starting point for where you should grow this. And I think there's a lot of work being done, again, down in Brazil on trying to avoid, and this goes for sustainability standards, avoiding those areas where you do have high amounts of biodiversity.
Well, and maybe not avoiding, but also integrating as well, and how those two systems can perhaps work together. And I know also there's some talk in regulatory circles about requiring different rotations so as to at least lower the impact from harvesting on biodiversity.
Well, I hope that at least gets a partial answer to your question.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a skeptic. I think the long-term environmental and soil mining implications and groundwater implications for ethanol are just make it a lose-lose situation. And I hope that, you know, during this week you've got some naysayers who will step forward from the scientific community. I understand that, you know, we have two lawyers on the program, and I certainly respect their perspectives. But, you know, if you think about energy conversion and if you think about inputs necessary, either with the miscanthus or prairie systems, you know, it really simply comes down to fueling our transportation system, you know, with the base cation load that we've been gifted in our soils. And, you know, considering the implements necessary and the petroleum inputs, I just hope that that's, you know, part of this equation. And I wanted to offer in that light, of course, a friendly correction. You know, the market in the United States didn't manufacture any ethanol last year. The market and government subsidies made a lot of ethanol in the United States last year. So anyway, that's my comment. David, thanks for the show.
Okay.
All the work.
All right.
Bye.
Well, you comment on that any way you like.
Well, I think what you're going to see in the second day of our conference, which is dedicated to discussing, talking about sustainability standards for biofuels, and we do have some engineers on the program. It's not they're not all attorneys, and what I can say that will occur is that there will be a discussion about the effects of biofuels on the environment, and not just a greenhouse gas reduction, but the concerns that you raise, like soil quality, groundwater considerations. If you look at either standards that are in place or standards that are being considered, and you look at even voluntary standards from certifiers in the world, sustainable agricultural certifiers, you'll see those considerations in principle, you know, preservation of groundwater or avoidance of interference with local access to water, and then you'll see the criteria and measurements for that. So they are being considered. That's not to say that it will ever stop governments from considering biofuels as a policy tool, because they have, you know, other benefits, you know, in addition to their environmental benefits, their energy security considerations, economic development considerations. So that will definitely be a topic of discussion on Saturday at our conference.
Well, we're about midway through. Actually, we're a little bit past the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and maybe I should take the opportunity to introduce again our guests. Jody Enders works in the Biofuels Law and Regulation Program as part of the Energy Biosciences Institute within the U of I Institute for Genomic Biology. She's an attorney by her training, and her particular area of expertise is agricultural, food, and environmental law. Brian Enders is Assistant Professor of Agricultural Law in ACES, the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the U of I. Also holds appointments with the Business Economics and Law Program and also the Energy Biosciences Institute. Within the Institute for Genomic Biology, they are agricultural lawyers and particularly interested in environmental law. And part of the reason that we're talking is just to mention that there is this conference going on, this first annual Biofuels Law and Regulation Conference happening on the U of I campus this weekend, Friday and Saturday. If people, by the way, are interested in finding out more information about the conference, I'm sure you have a website you can direct them to.
We do. It's www.biofuelslawconference.org. Registration is required, but it is free. We'd encourage you, if you would like to come, you're very welcome, but please register, because we do need to know who you are and we need to prepare enough food.
All right, good. And I also want to mention, too, that here we're planning on, for here on Focus 580, sometime over the next few weeks or months, we want to do some more programs that have to do with renewable energy. So what we'll be trying to do is find some people to talk about biomass. I'm sure we'll have to talk about ethanol. We'll try to get at a variety of perspectives, but we also want to get some people to talk about solar and wind turbines and geothermal and all the various things that people are thinking about. So again, just kind of talk about what they are, how they work, what potential they are, what sort of research is going on. I'm sure we'll have maybe some people on from the U of I and also from other universities and other places to talk about these things. And certainly, you know, if people who are listening have particular suggestions on things they'd like us to talk about, you know, you can let us know. You can drop us a letter, send us an email, whatever you want to do. I want to get back to here callers. We have someone in Belgium, the community, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. At best, biomass fuels can be carbon neutral, which I don't think they really are by the time you consider all your inputs and all the effort it takes to convert them to ethanol. It seems that if you would take this same biomass and convert it to hydrogen, we'd all be far better off with our carbon footprint. And why don't we go in that direction? I understand that ethanol is probably an easier step to go to, but it really doesn't solve our carbon problem. Going to hydrogen is a much better solution in that problem.
I think the caller is correct in that hydrogen may be a better solution in the long run, but I don't think we know how to get there yet. And in a lot of respects, we're at the Energy Biosciences Institute reacting to where the federal government has set its priorities. Sure, there's research going on how to get to the hydrogen economy, but we're still in the carbon economy, and we have to do something immediately to solve the greenhouse gas problem. And even if I'll accept your principle that at best it's carbon neutral, it's still better than the alternative we have now, and we need to do something in today and in the next 20 years before we can make that leap to the hydrogen economy. And again, it's where the incentives are at the federal level and at the state level to how to get there. And you're not seeing those incentives yet at the hydrogen, trying to get to the hydrogen economy.
Except in California, there are several incentives and a lot of money, more so than with biomass this year, for infrastructure at least in R&D.
Also, other countries are pushing very, very hard in hydrogen. Iceland, some of the northern European countries are all pushing in this direction. And it seems that we need to push that incentive much more. If we're going to invest all this money into this, why not invest it in the next leap instead of making a baby step towards it?
That's a good question.
And I think that also depends on whether you accept the premise that, you know, fuels made from biomass are at best carbon neutral. And we have several economists and scientists at EBI who are looking at that very complicated question. There are some that would argue that they are actually beneficial and they have a positive carbon value in that if you value, say, the byproducts or you look at the efficiency in processing or there are a lot of variables that go into that I don't think at this point we can come to an absolute conclusion on that, which then policymakers will say, well, then we're not going to throw, you know, all of our eggs in one basket at this point.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. It was not all that long ago. Oil prices were very high. We were going great guns on biofuels. It seemed like it was a rapidly growing industry. Then the price of oil dropped. And people were asking questions about, well, what exactly is the future of corn-based ethanol? Now, you know, we may come up again. It's been sort of an up and down ride. But I guess here what I'm thinking about is if we're really saying as a matter of policy, what we want to do is move into second generation biofuels. So say instead of relying so much on a corn-based ethanol, we're going to do a cellulosic ethanol, something like the kinds of things that we've been talking about. What do we do for those people who have invested heavily in the business of corn ethanol? I mean, as government, what does government do, or do we do anything for them?
Well, I think you're seeing the tax incentives starting to phase out for corn-based ethanol, and you are going to see then that cap of 15 billion gallons a year on corn-based ethanol. And as soon as you have that cap and the tax incentives start to go away, you're only going to have the large producers, so to say, mm-hmm. that are going to be able to compete in that sort of market. But you did see the struggle with corn-based ethanol, and it was interesting to look at as you saw the price of corn going up. From an observer of policy, you looked at how it divided the corn growing community and the livestock producing community, because as corn was being shifted to the ethanol plant, it drove up the cost of feed, mm-hmm. and so there's a lot of swirling policy objectives out here. But in my view, now this is assuming that the federal government continues to go down the renewable fuel standard that's put in place by the energy bill we have in force right now. Mm-hmm. Government can always change its policy; it would just take an act of Congress.
Well, do you think that given the fact that we've been going this direction for a while? And what all we've really done is we've said, well, maybe we're going to think differently about how we're going to produce, that what our sources for the biofuel are going to be. It's not that we've said, well, we're just going to give up on biofuels in particular. I mean, you don't think that the drive towards increasing the amount of the liquid transportation fuel that comes from biofuel, we're not going to change, are we?
I don't foresee that whatsoever. I think as the technology gets better and better and you're able to start converting these waste materials or these biomass dedicated crops, it's going to be that much easier for the government to support this mm-hmm. policy going forward.
But do you think that will someone say for people who have really been heavily into producing ethanol from corn that we're going to try to provide some package of incentives for you rather than we don't want you just to go out of the business, but maybe what you can do is thinking about make it, even though it would be extreme, you know, maybe difficult, maybe impossible, going to a different feedstock. Maybe we'll try to provide you some reason to say, okay, we're not going to do corn anymore. We're going to do something else. We're not going to give up.
Yeah,
but that's not going to be easy or cheap, I'm sure.
No, I don't think that's not unforeseeable whatsoever. I also think you're going to see existing corn ethanol plants that maybe can't compete on a cost structure with other corn ethanol plants start to convert to a cellulosic model. I mean, you have some infrastructure that can be duplicated in the process. In the ideal world is you would have a plant, and this is in the long range, where you can take any feedstock. You could take corn. If corn prices were low, you could take switchgrass, you could take miscanthus, you could take construction waste, and sort of whatever you would put in, you'd be able to have an enzyme and cocktail, so to say, that's mm-hmm. going to produce mm-hmm. ethanol at the back end of that.
Well, and I think you're also seeing federal government recognition through their grant programs and other R&D programs to help existing plants retrofit to be able to handle various biomass streams to avoid that sort of volatility that we've seen in the market.
Right. Well, we have about 6-7 minutes left. We have some other callers, so let's go next to Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a two-part question. The first involves sort of the scientific review of biofuels, and I've been involved with some processes and involved with environmental standards for production processes, and it seems to me that often the environmental considerations don't so much take a back seat as they sort of get tied to the back bumper and drug down the road, and it seems like the fault line for that falls along the lines of biodiversity, that specific concept, and I was hoping that you might address a couple things about that. First of all, you mentioned that there were going to be engineers involved with this process that would talk about, you know, some of the scientific concerns for biodiversity and biofuel production, but engineers aren't specifically qualified to deal with things like biodiversity, and that really seems to be where a lot of these processes fall apart. An engineer thinks about an ecosystem as a machine, doesn't realize, you know, some of the embedded complexities there, talks about, well, we can fix it this way, we can fix it that way, when in fact almost all engineered systems have inferior biodiversity that they produce extinctions, they don't work quite as well. So I'm concerned about that, specifically biodiversity and how it's relating to this and what's kinds of things are being done to address things like biodiversity with prairie grass. I mean, the miscanthus situation seems very alarming. And then also, what about waste streams from wastewater treatment plants and things like that? Some of the most productive systems in the world are shallow aquatic systems, and it seems like there's a lot of biomass production that goes on there. They're building artificial wetlands right now to capture a lot of that nitrogen that's polluting our streams and phosphorus that's polluting our streams. Can't that carbon be fixed in those systems? What's happening along those lines? And I'll try as much as possible just to listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay.
I can address the first part of the caller's question. And in terms of environmental considerations in the past, taking a backseat, and that might be true. What you're seeing now in the development of sustainability standards for biofuels is a consideration for the environment in terms of an environmental impact statement, or at least an environmental assessment. And for some of these, in some of these schemes, for biofuels to qualify either toward the mandate or for payments, incentivization payments, the fuel supplier or the biomass producer will have to, as part of their certification, indicate whether they've done an environmental assessment or environmental impact statement.
Can I inject really quickly here for myself and a lot of people that feel similarly to the way I do? Environmental impact statements don't really accomplish anything. I mean, what what's going on in the developing of these processes that prevents, you know, more prairie land being lost to Mercantus? You know, where does biodiversity fit in here? Where is the value? I mean, it's not in an EIA.
Well,
it never shows up.
I disagree with that. I mean, if you look at the standards that are being developed, not only is biodiversity a separate principle, but it also is part of some of the criterion for an environmental review. Whether there's a question of enforcement or the sort of veracity of those sort of, you know, certifications is another question,
yes,
but they are being considered.
Okay.
And my comment about the engineers at our conference speaking on Saturday, one of the engineers, Dr. Arnaldo De Silva Walter, is actually the task force leader from the International Energy Agency Task 40. He works with several scientists, plant scientists, biodiversity specialists throughout the world in developing these sort of considerations for sustainability. So although he may be an engineer, he cooperates with several very well-respected experts in the world on biodiversity and setting up these recommendations for sustainability standards.
Thank you. And then the question about wastewater treatment streams.
Yeah, I think that's a question that's beyond my particular expertise.
Well, I was recently at a meeting at the iHotel where there was a person there from Tuscola who talked about how they're taking wastewater from their treatment plants and using it to irrigate biomass crops. So, I mean, I think that is occurring. I mean, not just in Tuscola, but, you know, probably throughout the world, at least considering that in terms of a water conservation criterion and sustainability standards, probably.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a graduate student and researcher at the University of Illinois, and this is kind of stuff I study, sustainable agriculture and specifically biofuels from a very broad kind of societal perspective. And there's just one quick thing that I want to add to this conversation that hasn't been discussed too much, although you said in future shows you might, and that is solar and wind, because biofuels, you can do a lot of analysis comparing different biofuels, and some of them will end up looking good, some of them won't end up looking good in terms of net productivity per acre. But if you compare biofuels to photovoltaic panels and wind generation, they look foolish. They look absolutely just ridiculous. So if you're talking about how should we generate power to cover the electricity or the general energy needs of society, if you do actual analysis comparing these different methods, what you're going to find is that growing food and putting tons of energy inputs into a piece of land in order to create energy instead of food just doesn't compare to putting photovoltaic panels in the desert, putting them on top of your house, in a place like central Illinois that has tons of wind, putting up large wind generation plants and taking public money to subsidize that sort of thing instead of taking public money to subsidize taking our very productive cropland out of food production and into energy production. Thank you.
All right. Well, again, I don't – you can respond any way you like. I don't know that necessarily anybody is saying we have to either do one or the other. But for the foreseeable future, at least, we're going to need liquid transportation fuel. And so the question is, well, okay, what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, I think it's all about you need a mix of energy sources. Certainly, you know, solar, wind, hydro, I mean, you know, offshore hydro type things can create electricity. But at this point, we still need some sort of substitute or a supplement, we'll say, for liquid transport fuel and ethanol. Seems to be, you know, one of the options right now. There's also other liquid fuels, butanol, you know, for example, which we do a fair amount of research on the U of I campus as well. Those are sort of solving the liquid fuel transportation issue.
Well, we're coming down to the point where we pretty much have to finish. And as I said earlier, this has been one of these things that on and off we have touched on, and I'm sure that we will come back to it. And we certainly don't, we're not trying to take a position either for or against one way or another. I'm sure we'll talk some more about these things in the future and with different people who have different perspectives, both people who think that it's a good thing and people who really have some questions. So we can, you know, have a good discussion on all these things. Just as a way, though, of finishing up here, what sort of idea would you like to leave with folks?
I think one of the important ideas is to think about what's the potential for Illinois as a mode of economic development. And you're starting to hear people talk about, you know, the Midwest, and especially Illinois as the center point of the Midwest, could really be a hub for innovation in biofuels. And, you know, maybe you could call it the Silicon Valley of the Midwest, as sort of, you know, California for computer technology. We have the climate, we have infrastructure, we have farmers who are soils. Interested in this, the soils, which you really can't duplicate anywhere else, that we have a nice mix of fixed resources. And now we're starting to see investment in financial capital to really become a hub for bioenergy research. Yeah.
And I think, David, you mentioned how you want to continue the discussion on this, and I think that's one thing that the Biofuels Law and Regulation Program really wants to achieve through our conference, is a really good discussion on all of the issues, for example, that all of your callers raised. Yep. That's really something that I hope we can take away from this.
Well, I'm sure we'll get back to this topic again in the future. For the moment, though, we're going to have to leave it right there. Our guest, Jody Enders, she's a part of the Biofuels Law and Regulation Program within the Energy Biosciences Institute as part of the GE Institute for Genomic Biology here at the U of I. Brian Enders, he's Assistant Professor of Agricultural Law in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the U of I. And if people, again, the website, if they want to know about this conference?
It's www.biofuelslawconference.org.
All right. Thanks very much.